Hare Krishna. So welcome all of you to this morning where I'll continue on the series on Shikshashtakam. So we have taken five classes till now. The first was we took two classes and thereafter one class per verse. Today we are on the fifth text of the Shikshashtakam. Ainanda tanuja kinkaram patitamma vishame bhavam budhav kripaya tava pada pankaja sthitadhuli sadrusham vichintaya. So, Ainanda Tanuja Kinkaram. So, oh Krishna. Krishna is being addressed here with a very intimate address. Nanda Tanuja, the son of Nanda Maharaj. I'll come back to this reference significance a little later. Kinkara. Kara means to do. King means what? So, Kinkara means one who asks, what should I do? That means the word Kinkara implies one who is a servant, who asks the master what I should be doing. I Nanda Tanuja Kinkaram. O Nanda Tanuja, O Krishna, I am your servant. I Nanda Tanuja Kinkaram. Patitam maam vishame bhavam budhav. Patitam. I have fallen in this material existence. Vishame bhavam budhav. Material existence which is filled with many great dangers. Krupaya tavapada pankaja. By your mercy, unto your lotus feet. Stita dhuli sadrusham vichintaya. Accept me as a dhuli, as a dust particle at your lotus feet. Sadrusham, just like that. There are many important points in this verse. Before going into that, let's look at its position. This is the fifth among the eight texts. And this is the first text in which directly within the Shikshashtakam, the concept of Krupa is talked about. Mercy. Now, there is this contradiction or paradox between endeavor and grace. So, if we look at the Western religions, they have the idea, especially Christianity has the idea, that heaven can never be earned. It has to be got only through grace. And they hold that it is Jesus' sacrifice which is the qualification for the grace of all living beings. And when Western scholars came to India and they started studying the Indian tradition, the most prominent expression of the Indian tradition was impersonalism at that time. And they felt this impersonalist idea of we becoming one with God. This is absolute anathema. It is completely opposed to the Christian idea of grace. And later, as they studied the Indian traditions more, they found that there is also bhakti within it. And the principle of grace in bhakti is not only similar to what is there in Christianity, but it is actually much deeper, much greater. As a prominent Christian theologian, Ajit Wilson, he said, I am not a Hindu, but I find the Hindu understanding of grace is actually far more graceful than the Christian understanding of grace. Why is that? He said, because the Christian understanding is always very limited. Limited in the sense that there's only one savior. There's Jesus, and if you accept Jesus, you're going to be saved. And there's only one life. In this life, one has to accept Jesus and then one goes back to heaven. If one doesn't, then one goes to hell forever. So you see, in contrast, in the bhakti tradition, there are many, many avatars. And there are many, many lifetimes. So if one is not attracted to so much towards one particular incarnation, one can attracted to some other incarnation. There are so many spiritual teachers, there are so many levels of spiritual paths. And of course, there are many lifetimes. Even if a soul does not evolve in this lifetime, that soul can evolve in another lifetime. So now, the major problem which even these Christians who accepted the path of bhakti, I'll come later to why I'm talking about this from a Christian perspective. I'll explain that a little later. But the major problem they had was with the idea of sadhana in the Vedic tradition. They felt that sadhana or endeavor on the spiritual path indicates a lack of faith in God. Their idea is that when we do sadhana, then that means we are by our endeavor expecting to earn the right to attain God. And they felt that this idea of endeavor is completely opposite to the idea of grace. And because of that, they said, even the bhakti traditions are actually contaminated by the emphasis on sadhana. So now Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur was responding to many such Christians when he said, we cannot gate crash into Vaikuntha. He said, one cannot gate crash into Vaikuntha. Sometimes the gate is locked and some people come with a big truck and they just break the truck and come inside. So he said that actually the purpose of sadhana is not to make us qualified for mercy. Mercy itself is, in the Vedic tradition also, it is said to be ahaituki. Ahaituki means it has no hetu, it is causeless. So then, if mercy is causeless, then what is the purpose of sadhana? The purpose of sadhana is twofold. First is that in the process of spiritual growth, there are two aspects. One is, Jiva Goswami in his Sandarbhas explains that there is becoming guna-atita and becoming swarupa-siddha. Becoming guna-atita means going beyond the influence of the three modes. We are all influenced by sattva-guna, rajoguna, tamoguna. And these modes create different kinds of desires within us. Suddenly we feel greedy, suddenly we feel angry. Suddenly certain desires come in and we dance like puppets according to those desires. This is the influence of the modes. Guna, to become guna atita means to go beyond the influence of the modes. And to become swarupa siddha. Swarupa siddha means we all have an eternal position in the spiritual world. And that position is what we need to become aware of. So, in disease terms, Srila Prabhupada sometimes explains that becoming guna-atita is like removing the infection. If somebody has got a terrible disease and then by treatment all the germs are removed. But after that there is a period of convalescence when the person recovers the energy. So just removal of disease is not the same as restoration of health. After removal of disease, there is the positive restoration of health. So, becoming guna-atita is like the removal of the disease. And becoming swarupa-siddha is like the restoration of the health. Now, by sadhana, what is possible is to become guna-atita. By consistent practice of sadhana, a person can raise themselves from the mode of ignorance to the mode of passion. They can raise themselves to the mode of goodness and to some extent towards transcendence, not fully. So changing one's modes is possible through endeavor. And we see even in material life, there are people who may be addicted to drugs or alcohol or cigarettes or whatever. And they may go to some de-addiction programs and some of them are able to give up the addictions. Many of them are unable to and many of them may also have relapses. But still, there are people who are able to break free from certain bad habits. So, by our endeavor, it is possible to overcome the influence of the lower modes. Not to totally transcend the modes, but to significantly elevate oneself above the modes, that is possible. And the higher the mode we are situated in, if we are situated in the mode of goodness, then we can practice bhakti with greater focus. The process of bhakti can be started from any mode. But to be sustained, it is good to be in the mode of goodness. Evam tada rajastamo bhava kama lobha dayasche cheta etair anamidham sthitam sattve prasivati. So when Krishna, in the Bhagavatam, in the second chapter of the first canto, it is mentioned that tada rajastamo bhava, when the lower modes are removed, kama lobha dayasche, the characteristics are lust and greed. When these are removed, Then what happens? Cheta etai anavittam. The consciousness becomes cleansed. And after that, stitam sattve. One becomes situated in sattva guna. And what happens when one is situated in sattva guna? Prasidati. One becomes cheerful. Evam prasanna manaso bhagvat bhakti yogataha bhagvat tattva vijnanam mukta sangasya jayate. And then, with prasanna manaso, with cheerful mind, when one practices bhakti, bhagvat bhakti yogataha, when one practices bhakti yoga like this, then what happens? Bhagvat tattva vijnanam. The systematic understanding of God awakens within one's heart. And then, mukta sangasya jayate, one becomes completely liberated from the modes, from all material association, in fact. So, we are talking about this sequence. So, in the mode of goodness, one becomes prasanna manaso. Till we have not come to the mode of goodness, we can practice bhakti, but because there are so many other desires, there is resentment. Oh, I have to give that up, I have to give that up. Oh, I have to do this so much. And sometimes I like it, sometimes I don't like it. But once we come to the mode of goodness, we become steady in our bhakti practice. And we become joyful in our bhakti practice. So now this, coming to the mode of goodness, is possible through our sadhana. If we diligently practice sadhana, we can come to the mode of goodness. But we cannot realize ourselves entirely to be parts of Krishna and our swarupa merely by practice, merely by sadhana. For that we need kripa. So sadhana helps us to rise to the more higher modes by which we can practice bhakti more steadily and cheerfully. And sadhana serves one more purpose. Sadhana doesn't earn Krishna's mercy, but sadhana shows Krishna our desire for his mercy. It's like if there are some beggars on the street, now some passing people may give charity. Now when the passing people give charity, that charity is in a sense causeless, ahaituki. Now, some beggar may beg very fervently. Say, hey, you know, I have got a family and they are all starving. My child is sick and he is about to die of starvation. I have not eaten for 3 days. And now when he begs like this, at that time, some passerby may give charity. That begging is not the job done to earn the charity as a salary. The begging may attract the salary. Sorry, begging attract the charity, but the begging is not the cause of the charity. Last time I also discussed the difference between the cause and the stimulus. Cause is like when a person shoots a gun, when the pressing the trigger may seem to be the cause of the bullet going and killing someone. But actually pressing the trigger is simply the stimulus of the trigger. If there had been no gun present in the bullet, then pressing the trigger will have no effect. So, pressing the trigger is actually a trigger. The presence of the bullet in the gun is the cause of somebody getting wounded by a gunshot. Similarly, a person may beseech fervently, please, I'm starving, give me some food, give me some money. But if there is no compassion in the heart of the passerby, no amount of beseeching will invoke any charity. So, the cause of the charity is the compassion of the giver. The stimulus is the begging by the person. And sometimes, even without the stimulus also, the beggar may just be sitting rejected and a passerby may go and give charity. So, Krishna's mercy is causeless. Our sadhana does not make us qualified to receive Krishna's mercy. Our sadhana simply shows Krishna our desire. And it is because of his compassionate nature that Krishna responds and bestows mercy. So, in the previous verses in this text, if you just look at just the previous verse, there the focus was on human endeavor. Na dhanam, na janam, na sundarim, na kavitam. So, he's saying, I don't want this, I don't want that, I don't want that. Essentially, sadhana is a process of saying no to temptation and saying yes to Krishna. When we are chanting, when we are hearing scripture, when we are studying scripture, when we are coming in association, at these times we could be doing many other things. We could be saying yes to many other things, but we say no to those things and we say yes to Krishna. So sadhana essentially is a process of saying no to the world's temptations and saying yes to Krishna. So the previous text, even before that, look at the third text also, where it is said, one cultivates humility, trunadapi sunichena tanorapi sahishna amanina manadena kirtaniya sadahari. There the idea is cultivate humility and tolerance by which one can come to a level of constant glorification of the Lord. Now even in this, the emphasis is on what one is doing. That is the sadhana part. So third and fourth text especially talk about the sadhana. The first and second text talk about the glory of the holy name. Now in the fifth text, the central point is Krupa. Oh Lord, please have mercy on me. And what is the mercy that is being asked? Ainanda tanuja kinkaram patitam. My dear Lord, I have fallen in this material existence. And please lift me out. Oi vishame bhavam buddhav. Srila Prabhupada, in his translation of this text, adds somehow or the other, I have fallen in material existence. So, the cause of how we came to the material existence is something which is extremely elusive. And quite often, you know, Srila Prabhupada, when he makes some statements, often on an issue he makes many statements. And at different points, he may stress different things. But sometimes we just take one statement of Srila Prabhupada and overemphasize it. But Srila Prabhupada was very broad, and at different times he said different things. Sometimes he would say the exact opposite things. And the reason for that would be the context. So sometimes Prabhupada would say that some devotee wrote up to Prabhupada and said that, Prabhupada, I want to help you spread Krishna consciousness all over the world and save the whole world. And Prabhupada said, this is good, but first we should save ourselves. So Prabhupada was bringing the person down on the ground. Another time, one devotee wrote, Prabhupada, I am so fallen. I am utterly worthless without your mercy. And Prabhupada wrote back saying, I need many fallen people like you to help me save the whole world. So, depending on the consciousness of a person, Prabhupada would respond differently at different times. And this is easy to understand when there is a direct one-to-one correspondence. You know, okay, this person's background will be different, this person's background will be different. But the same principle applies when Srila Prabhupada speaks various things also, on various issues also. So, sometimes it is said that, sometimes the devotees have the notion that Prabhupada said that the soul fell from the spiritual world. Now, that is not the only thing that Prabhupada said. In the fourth canto purport, Prabhupada clearly states that therefore the conclusion is that the soul never falls from the spiritual world. So the point is, Prabhupada made different statements on this issue. In some statement, especially in his conversations, he tends to say that the soul falls from the spiritual world. And in his written works, in his purports, he basically takes a non-committal position. Sometimes he says the soul doesn't fall, sometimes he says the soul falls, or like here, somehow or the other. The point is, we should not reduce Prabhupada to one position, because we have to know that we are not just, we are the Krishna Consciousness Movement, but also the Krishna Consciousness Movement is a part of a bigger tradition. There is the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, and the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition is a part of the broader Vaishnava tradition. Now, before Srila Prabhupada, no Acharya, either from our Sampradaya or from any other Sampradaya, has ever taken the position that the soul fell from the spiritual world. There is no explicit statement in scripture saying that the soul fell from the spiritual world. So, when Srila Prabhupada makes a particular statement, we have Bhaktivinoda Thakur saying that some souls fall from Brahma Jyoti, not from Goloka Vrindavan, not from Vaikuntha. Srila Prabhupada makes this statement, but when Srila Prabhupada is asked about it, he never gave any direct support from Sadhu or Shastra for that. He basically said that it is an inconclusive question. He says, don't get into this too much. So, this position, somehow or the other, this is a position which is a position of intellectual humility. I mentioned in an earlier talk that humility can be expressed in different ways in different situations. So, humility in the intellectual realm means admitting that I don't know and admitting that I can't know. I don't know and I can't know. Certain things are unknowable. Purusha in 13.20, 21, 22, where the Bhagavad Gita talks about Purusha and Prakriti. So, Purusham Chaiva Vidyanadi Upavapi Vikaramshi Gunamshi Vidhi Prakriti Sambhavan. So, Prakritim Purusham Chaiva Vidhi Anadi Upavapi. Both of them are Anadi. Prakriti and Purusha, both are Anadi. Beginningless. So, both Valde Vidyabhushan and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, both of them in their commentary to this word state that this Anadi refers not only to Purusha and Prakriti but also to the contact of Purusha and Prakriti. That means Purusha refers to the body, Purusha refers to the soul, Prakriti refers to the body. So our body can say matter. So matter is also eternal, material forms are temporary, but matter is eternal. Matter is eternal, soul is eternal. And they explain the contact of the matter and the soul is also eternal. It's anadi. So technically speaking, the word anadi does not mean eternal, it means beginningless. It just has no beginning. So we don't have to get too caught up in such technicalities. So sometimes some devotees may say the soul fell from the spiritual world. If that's what they want to believe, that's fine. Some other devotees say, no, there is no basis, the soul did not fall from the spiritual world. That's also fine. But basically, this is an unknowable subject. And we all in our spiritual life have to decide what is important for us. And really how the soul came is something which is not very important. The standard example that we give is somebody has got malaria. It is not important to know which mosquito bit you to give the malaria. The important thing is take the treatment. So like that, the origin is not as important as the cure. So Prabhupada uses the word somehow or the other over it. So Ainand Tanujaking Karam Patitam Mam Vishame Bhavambudu. The point is Patitam. I am fallen right now. And how one has become fallen, that is not as important as the fact that we are fallen, and more important, the fact that we have an opportunity to become elevated. Patitam mam vishame bhavam budhau. I have fallen in this material existence. Krupaya tava pad pankaja. Krupaya, my dear Lord, please by mercy tava pad pankaja. That you rise, you please lift me onto your lotus feet. So, I'll now come to the point of why I'm talking all this I started this talk from a Christian perspective. Because Christianity has a particular perspective of bhakti. And there are certain Hindu groups who say that actually the Krishna consciousness movement is very much influenced by Christianity in its missionary mode. And one of the things they say is this idea of the fall of the jiva. This is actually a Christian import into Hinduism. Because in Christianity, they have the concept of the fall of the soul. Now, Adam and Eve were there. And Adam, because Eve was tempted by Satan, and then the Adam and Eve both fell from Eden. And they said this idea of the fall is what has been imported into Hinduism by ISKCON. Now, this is a complete misunderstanding. Why? Because the Christian conception of a fall is very, very different. Their idea is Adam and Eve lived long, long millions of years ago. Whenever it was, not millions, thousands of years ago. And from that time, they sinned. So their idea is because Adam and Eve sinned and all of humanity is a descendant of Adam and Eve, so everybody since then has sinned. So sin, rather than being a matter of individual misuse of free will, sin becomes, within this worldview, something like a genetic defect. You know, Adam and Eve sinned, and from that time, for all of humanity has got this inherent, inborn genetic defect. That is what all of us are sinners. So now to take this, now this is not the understanding of all branches of Christianity. Just like within Hinduism, there are so many different groups with very different philosophical positions. Like that, Christianity also has a wide variety of interpreters. And what the fall of Adam and Eve means, different people have different ideas. But if we take the whole Adam and Eve fall literally, their idea becomes all evil, all suffering that is there in this world That is because of the original sin of Adam and Eve. And then it becomes very, very unreasonable, because all the tsunamis, all the earthquakes, all the heart attacks, all the catastrophes, all of them happened because someone ate an apple long ago. You know, now this is, I'm not making a caricature of Christianity here. I'm just saying that if one takes everything literally, then this is the implication. And all suffering is caused by evil, and the original evil act, which has led to the evil in all of humanity, is the eating of a forbidden apple. So now this is a very, very different concept from the whatever Srila Prabhupada talks about. It is an individual misuse of free will by each soul. Whereas there it is the idea of misuse of one of free will by one individual thousands of years ago. So the two are very different concepts entirely. One of the defining differences between that understanding of the fall and the Vedic understanding of the fallen state is that actually the fallen state is the embodied condition. The soul is pure. The soul is in an embodied condition, and to have a body, whatever be the nature of the body, that is a bond, that is a condition of bondage, and that is a condition of being fallen. Whereas there the idea is Adam and Eve, whatever form they were in, from that very form they came over here. And that idea of a fall is what leads to the idea of bodily resurrection within that idea. That, you know, the body should be buried, because when the body is buried, the person will be resurrected, just like Jesus was resurrected. They will be resurrected just like that in future. This is a very different conception. So, the point which I am making again is coming to somehow or the other purposes. We don't have to get too much caught. If we wed ourselves to the idea that the soul fell from the spiritual world, then we find ourselves targeted as being non-shastric, as having something brought into our tradition from elsewhere. And if we insist that the soul did not fall from the spiritual world, then we have several statements of Prabhupada which do say the soul has fallen from the spiritual world. So what do we do in such a situation? We understand that we can't understand. So this is the attitude of humility. There are certain subjects which are not comprehensible. And actually, as I said, Srila Prabhupada did not take one position. Srila Prabhupada said, this is also acceptable, this is also acceptable. So sometimes when we think of faithfulness to parampara, we think this is one position and everybody has to agree with this position, then they are faithful. But the tradition is not just one line. Tradition is like a circle. Within that circle, there are different ways of serving Krishna that are acceptable. So as long as something is in within the circumference of that circle, that is fine. So if tomorrow somebody starts saying, you know, you are not the soul, you are the body. Now that is not acceptable at all. Because that is directly contradicting not just Guru, Sadhu, Shastra. So there are definitely things which are outside the circle and they cannot be accepted. But sometimes within the tradition there can be a range of positions which are acceptable. Not just one position with which everyone has to agree entirely. So Krupaya Tava Pada Pankaja, my dear Lord, by your mercy, unto your lotus feet, Stita Duli Sadrusham Vichindaya, please make me situated on your lotus feet. Please state me as a dust particle on your lotus feet. Now this idea of becoming a dust particle on the lotus feet of Krishna, what does it mean? Actually, all of us have our Swarupa in the spiritual world. I answer questions on my website. And just yesterday I was asked a question that, you know, in this life, according to our philosophy, if some soul is very fallen, and the soul gets animal body, to get a dog's body or to take an earthworm's body, it is a very unfortunate thing. So, he said, what determines if some soul becomes an animal in the spiritual world? If I go to the spiritual world and I become an animal, is it an unfortunate thing? I don't want to become an animal there. So the point is, if somebody thinks that I become a cow or I become a deer or something like that, I would like to become a gopa or a gopi. I don't want to become any of these things. But we shouldn't carry a material vision to the spiritual reality. See, first of all, as soon as a person becomes gunatita, a person becomes free from material contamination, at that time, the soul's joyfulness becomes fully evident. And Jiva Goswami in his Gopal Champu explains how everyone in Vrindavan is blissful. Whether it be a blade of grass, whether it be a deer, whether it be the Yamuna river, whether it be a gopi, a gopa, or anyone else, everybody is blissful. So this material diversity is created by variety of karmic qualifications. Somebody gets a good looking body because they have done some good karma. Somebody gets an animal body because they have done some bad karma. So the variety in material existence is because of disparity in karma. Different people have done different kinds of karma. But the variety in the spiritual world is not because of any disparity of karma. The variety in the spiritual world is simply meant to increase the flavor of happiness there. So everybody in the spiritual world, whatever be their swarupa, they are all eternally happy. Not just eternally happy, but fully happy. And the soul's happiness primarily is in the remembrance of Krishna, in the affection for Krishna. And whether one is a gopi who is embracing Krishna, whether one is a elderly mother or father of Krishna who are taking care of Krishna and feeding him, or whether one is a deer who dances in the forest, or a cow whom Krishna herds, all of them are absorbed in the remembrance of Krishna. And the happiness is not so much due to how much one is proximate to Krishna, how much one is close to Krishna. The happiness is how much one is remembering Krishna. And as far as devotion is concerned, everybody in the spiritual world has deep devotion, total devotion to Krishna. And that's why everyone is eternally happy there. So coming to this point of being situated on Krishna's lotus feet, what does it mean? Make me a dust particle at your lotus feet. It is not that any soul has to eternally be a dust particle at Krishna's lotus feet. Everybody has a swarupa. But the idea of becoming a dust particle at Krishna's lotus feet means becoming reinstated in our position as a servant. So a dust particle at a feet is considered to be a humble position. And that humility is what enables us to connect with Krishna. So, Krupayatava Pada Pankaja Sthita Dhuli Sadrusham Vichindaya. My dear Lord, please lift me up and place me as a dust particle at your lotus feet. And Krishna, when we are situated like this, then there is constant bliss in that remembrance of Krishna. Because Krishna is the source of all happiness. And whatever way we are connected with Him, as long as we are connected with Him, we are blissful. And this verse is a shift the focus, to summarize now. This was shift the focus from sadhana to krupa. We discussed how sadhana is not contradictory to krupa. Sadhana does not indicate a lack of faith as some people think. Sadhana serves two purposes. Sadhana can help us to progress towards becoming gunatita. Sadhana can help us to rise from the lower modes towards the higher modes. And sadhana can show Krishna our desire for His mercy. Just like a beggar's fervent begging can show a passerby that, oh, this person really needs food. Just as the beggar's begging will have no effect if there is no compassion in the passerby's heart. So similarly, our sadhana alone doesn't create Krishna's mercy, doesn't alone lead to our awakening of our soul. That happens by Krishna's mercy. So becoming gunatita is like becoming free from the infection of the disease. Becoming swarup siddha is like being restored to health positively. And that positive restoration to health doesn't happen without Krishna's mercy. Krishna's mercy is ahayutuki. Then we discussed about somehow or the other, how the soul has come to this material world. Prabhupada often took a variety of positions on various issues, and there is no need to absolutely wed our whole movement to one particular position. So Prabhupada said both things, that the soul fell from the spiritual world, or the soul is, so somehow or the other the soul is here. The soul doesn't fall from the spiritual world. as said in the Bhagavatam book. So the point is that the idea of the soul falling in the spiritual world, even if it doesn't have any basis in Guru Sadhu and Shastra, that does not mean that it is an import from somewhere else. The Christian conception is a very different thing. Because there the idea is, the body itself has fallen from there, and it is one person's misuse of free will that is cause of the sin for all people, like a genetic defect. It's a very different conception. And lastly, we discussed about when we talk about being situated as a dust particle of Krishna's lotus feet, that is not a position of insignificance. Every position in the spiritual world, even if it be the position of animal, that is a position of complete spiritual fulfillment. Because the spiritual fulfillment comes not by so much by our proximity to Krishna, it comes by our affinity for Krishna. It comes by how much we are attracted to Krishna, how much we are absorbed in the remembrance of Krishna. And that was that avenue for absorption is available for everyone. So thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments? Okay. Yes. So what do scriptures or other traditions say about the fall of the soul? Actually, they don't talk about the fall of the soul. They just basically say that this is untraceable, anadi. Bhaktivinoda Thakur also the famous song, anadi karma phale kori bhavarna ujane. That because of beginningless karma, I have fallen in this material existence. So usually the traditional Vedic position is to hold that the question of the origin of the soul is inscrutable. And no one takes any definitive position on that. And Prabhupada also did not take a definitive position. So this is a question which is generally not explored, because we are existing in the time domain, and that which is beyond the time domain is not comprehensible for us. So with that understanding, that question is not explored at all. And what is the other question? Yeah, so what does Swarupa Siddhi mean? Actually, the word Swarupa has many different meanings in different contexts. So, the Bhaktivinoda Thakur in his Jaiva Dharma, in Jaiva Dharma, he talks about two different positions. He says, for example, when the disciple becomes very advanced, the guru reveals the Swarupa to the disciple. And then the disciple understands, okay, I am this and this, and then the disciple starts practicing bhakti accordingly. But then he describes two sadhakas. Another sadhaka, he comes and tells his guru, after the guru really reveals the Swarupa, he tells the guru that, you know, I don't feel comfortable in this room. I just don't feel natural. I don't feel like practicing bhakti in this room. And then the guru prays, and the guru reveals another Swarupa. And then the disciple feels satisfied with that. And then he goes on. So he talks about both these things. So the idea that our Swarupa is something which is eternally fixed and the guru simply reveals it, that has been the mainstream position in our tradition. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur does talk about an alternative where the disciple and the guru, they discuss and then the Swarupa is revealed. So the idea is that we all have an eternal relationship with Krishna. And of course, there is other thing, a point also in our tradition, that it is said that even if somebody has a Swarupa somewhere else, if somebody is very much attracted to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, then that person can be transported to Chaitanya Lila. And there is also the point that some souls can be in both Leelas, can be in Krishna Leela also and in Gaur Leela also. So if a soul has immense attraction to Krishna, to the Supreme Lord, both his forms, Krishna as well as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the soul may go to both also. So exactly how the Swarupa plays out, is it that one soul expands into two, or there are two souls over there in two different Swarupas, or does the soul Swarupa change itself because of the desire of the soul? That is not clearly mentioned in our tradition. The important point is, from here, by the practice of bhakti, we become elevated, we become liberated, and we attain Krishna. Now, exactly what is our position in our relationship with Krishna? That is something which will be revealed to us when we get there. Yeah, so the question point here is the concept of five rasas and the concept of a swarupa in one of the five rasas. This whole concept of five rasa is a revelation of the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition. Other Vaishnava traditions don't talk about five rasas first. That doesn't mean that there is. See, the concept of five rasas is an analytical framework. Even if you go to Sri Vaishnava tradition or Madhava Vaishnava tradition, they also know that Yashodamai has a maternal relationship with Krishna, that Raktaka and Chitraka have a servitor relationship with Krishna, or Sudama, they have a fraternal relationship with Krishna. They know that. But making these relationships into analytical categories, this belongs here, this is something which our tradition, the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, has done. So because the other traditions don't have these analytical categories, so they don't talk about when the soul becomes liberated, whether the soul goes into one of these analytical categories or not. And in our own tradition, when the subject has been talked about, the focus has been on attaining the spiritual way. So Swarupa, if we see that way, in the Brihad Bhagavatam story, the soul actually goes to the spiritual world, soul goes to Vaikuntha, goes to Ayodhya and lives in Ayodhya, lives in Vaikuntha, but doesn't feel satisfied. And then comes back again to this world and then eventually goes to Goloka Vrindavan, practices sadhana in this world and then goes to Goloka Vrindavan and feels satisfied over there. So now the Brihad Bhagavatamrit is a story which is primarily meant to illustrate the exaltedness of service to Krishna in Goloka Vrindavan in the mood of Madhurya Rasa. And that is what is explained through the narrative of the Gopa Kumar. So the point is that the concept of Swarupa, the word Swarupa comes in scripture, but Swarupa as referring to one particular kind of relationship among these five analytical categories, that is something which it is our tradition that has talked about. And in our tradition, the first person to talk about the fall of the soul from the spiritual world is Srila Prabhupada. And Srila Prabhupada has not explicitly talked about this subject any further. That's why I can't say anything more. Any other questions? Yes.
You were saying the better things and the passerby and how do we attract the mercy of Krishna? Is it directly related to our getting knowledge? And is it directly proportional if somebody chanting 16 rounds or somebody chanting 64 rounds? So is it directly proportional to the number of rounds that we do in the lifetime that you attract mercy of Krishna? Or how does the mercy of Krishna come to picture? How does it decide to each person that this mercy is given?
So, is the mercy proportionate to our endeavor? No. If it becomes like that, then it becomes more of a... It is no longer remains causeless. So, certainly our endeavor increases the likelihood of getting mercy. And we shouldn't think that Krishna deliberately wants to withhold mercy and not give mercy to us. It's not like that. Prabhupada writes in the first canto purport that Krishna is more eager for us to come back to Him than we are eager to go to Him. So, Krishna is always eager, but He wants to see how much we are valuing what we are getting. Just like a father who is a billionaire, and the father wants to hand over all the inheritance to his children. But if he sees the children are frivolous, wasting their money in all sorts of frivolous activities, then although the father wants to give the inheritance to children, father will withhold at that time. Till the child becomes mature, and after the child becomes mature, the father will do the inheritance. So like that, Krishna wants to give us pure love for Him. But if He sees that we are still caught up in loving this and loving that and loving that, we will not value what He is giving. So the more we start valuing what we have, the more Krishna starts giving it to us. So it's not a linear or a mathematical proportionate thing. But the general principle is yatha mam prapadyante tam tathaiva prajamyam. It's a reciprocal relationship. So the more we surrender to Krishna, the more Krishna reveals Himself to us. And Krishna is Krishna's ultimate mercy. When Krishna manifests in our heart, in his all attractiveness, then that is his ultimate mercy. So Krishna is Krishna's greatest blessing. And he reveals that in proportion to our desire for him. So now, is it a matter of numerical counting? I don't think so. Because the point is that our heart should become open to Krishna. Now for some people, by chanting a lot of rounds, the heart's openness to Krishna increases. For some other people, just chanting around more and more just causes a sense of being too burdened, just becomes a number counting game. They're not really opening their heart to Krishna. Instead, they do some other services and they feel more connected with Krishna through those services. So we have to see how our heart opens most to Krishna. How we feel most connected to Krishna. We have a basic process of sadhana which we follow, but beyond that, depending on how we can be best connected with Krishna, we absorb ourselves in connecting with him accordingly. And as far as Krishna's mercy is concerned, it will come at his pace. As long as we are doing the endeavor, Krishna is not out there withholding his mercy. He wants us to open our heart, and when he sees we have opened our heart, he will give his mercy to us. Okay. This last question. So when we get things without endeavor, then often we may take them for granted. So how do we understand why did we get this or what do we do about this? Yeah. Actually, just a couple of months ago I was in Singapore. And in Singapore is the only country in the world where ISKCON is officially banned. So it is one of the places where we cannot do any public programs. We can do programs, but not as ISKCON. They have a Gita reading society over there. So then it struck me that the things which we take so natural over in India, they're so difficult in many other parts of the countries. So now, how is it that we have so much facility to practice bhakti, some other people don't have the facility to practice bhakti. Now we can look at a circumstantial reason, there the government is inimical, or there in the past some people did something because of which the government became hostile. Or if you go to the Middle East, we may say that, okay, Middle East or communist China, wherever, the government is hostile. That's the cause. Now yes, there may be socio-political, socio-cultural considerations which may make the atmosphere less or more favorable for the practice of bhakti. The important thing is the soul's relationship with Krishna doesn't depend on any circumstances. So the same circumstances which are hostile can, if the soul is sincere, they can make the soul's desire for Krishna more intense. And so there the devotees may not have any temple where, especially in the Middle East, the devotees have no temple where they can go. But then at their home itself they have a temple that they worship in the temple with greater devotion. Now that cannot substitute in an absolute sense for the having a proper temple where there are installed deities. But still, whatever we have, if we use it or if we absorb ourselves in it, Krishna can manifest himself through that. So rather than going into the cause, is it that the devotees who are practicing in Singapore, you know, they have done some bad karma because of which they got in Singapore, and because of which now they are there where they cannot have, or in Middle East or whatever. We don't have to go into that analysis of past karma. Our focus should be on what I can do right now. Because you know, getting into the analysis of past karma is something which is very, very judgmental at times. If a person is poor, if I start thinking this person did bad karma because of which they are poor, well then where is my compassion in that? Where is my sense of duty? Where will we stop them? If a baby is crying, should the mother think, the baby is crying because of her past karma? No, the baby is meant to take care of the baby. So like that, we shouldn't go too much into the analysis of past karma. That's the first thing. So whatever facilities we have, if we tend to take them for granted, then quite often interacting with devotees who don't have similar facilities, that often helps in appreciating what we have. And quite also another thing is that we all have to go through a learning curve. So some of us may learn by hearing, some of us may have to learn by experiencing. It's best to learn by hearing, but it may have to work that sometimes we are transferred somewhere, or we have to go somewhere where we don't have association, and then even the basic practices become very difficult. And then, see, even without association, we can practice bhakti. But it's like Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami compares the association of devotees to a walking stick. Now even without a walking stick, if a person has a little leg problem, they can walk without a walking stick. But it's much slower, and it's much more insecure. Any moment they will fall down. That's what happens with us when we don't have association. Now, our progress becomes slower and slower, and any moment we may fall away. Because there's no protection of association. So like that, even by contemplation, we can gain better appreciation of the gifts that we have. And that way, if we hear and learn, that is the best. Is that answer your question? Thank you very much. Shri Gauranga Mahaprabhu ki, Shri Shiksha Ashtakam ki, Shri Prabhupada ki, Rauhita Kandarindaki.
Thank you.